Okay, so I guess you noticed that me and Wen Fei had the same starting slide. This is the Chicago skyline. It was produced at Northwestern, so they don't pay us if we don't show the same. Okay, it was a joke. Okay, so thank you. Thanks. All right.
Sorry.
Okay, just to I go very quickly because most of the material has already been reviewed by the other speakers today. The sources of X-rays and radio we were looking for are jets, like jets that make it through the ejecta, these cocoons. One thing that wasn't mentioned so far is that we might also have X-rays coming from a central engine, and also in the interaction of the ejecta with the environment is also another potential source of radio emission. So why we do that? Because we want to learn both about the properties, intrinsic properties, and the properties of the environment. So I'm going to tell you right away that if you put the typical X-ray luminosity from spin-down luminosity of a magnetar, you put it inside of the kilonova ejecta, that is not going to make it. So this a source of X-ray emission is not come out of that. And if you take the merger ejecta, you let it go in the environment, that would definitely produce a radio emission that is indeed detectable with present-day facilities, but not now. So we need to wait like 10 years from now. All right, so what are we left with? So this is a discussion we've been having until now. So what we are looking at in the X-rays and radio, the product of a jet that made it through the ejecta, or is instead the product of something that is mostly spherical and mildly relativistic. And for me, the spherical mildly relativistic thing, I'm going to call it cocoon in this talk, and whatever is ultra-relativistic, collimated, and able to make it through the ejecta is going to call it a jet. Okay. And then, of course, we might be on axis or off axis. So I wanted to make two points during this talk. And the first point I want to make is that we need to allow the structure jet, which for me is something that makes it through the ejecta, has a luminous core, ultra-relativistic, and some wings, a chance to fail before ruling them out. And the second point is that the new X-rays, the ones that Chandra acquired yesterday and will acquire on Thursday, are very unlikely to settle this debate. And the reason is simple. Both cocoons and multi-relativistic cocoons and relativistic jets, ultra-relativistic jets, they can produce, they have a vast portion of the parameter space where they live and where they can produce the very same spectrum. So if both models match the radio, the present-day radio that we already know, by definition, the most likely case is that they will also match the X-rays. So we will not get the answer tomorrow. That's the message. All right, so the other point I want to make is the importance of science with zero photons that is very, very close to my heart. I think I'm building my career on this. So you all know the story. We got on target very, very early in the radio, and it was a non-detection, a very important non-detection here that put right away this the radio emission from GW-17-08-17 very far away from the only four short GRB radio afterglows that we know. Only four of them after all these efforts. So you read a little bit, and we just heard from Nora. The first observations we did at 2.4 days, we found two beautiful background photons over there. But it is exactly extremely important, and I have to say that it was not unexpected. The most likely scenario is that you are off axis, either if you expect a jet, just by probabilistic arguments. So it was not unexpected. So we wait a little bit more, and we had some X-rays coming into our view at 9 days with observations by the Goddard team, and then this is an image at 15 days with some 17 beautiful photons. All right, and right now we are in sunblock. We came out of sunblock yesterday, actually. All right, radio also came into view. We will hear more from Greg after me. So basically, the story that you got from X-rays and radio is that our rising emission that we have to try to explain. And even in the case for, also for the case of X-rays, this emission is way, way below the luminosity that we observe when we are facing on axis a jet, which is also not unexpected, I would say. So we have to explain this rising behavior together with some other properties. So the rising behavior is actually something that you can only say thanks to this extremely deep Chandra observations at 2 days. So this is why it was so important. And actually will be extremely important to understand what happened before. So in the future, we should try to get on target as soon as we can. And it has a mild rise, the luminosity is 39 arcs per second. And it has sort of a hard spectrum, even if we have a few photons, 17 photons, we can actually say something about the spectrum. And if you put it together with the radio, we know that is also following roughly the same SED, which is also a very important clue that they're coming from the same thing. So here is a compilation of data, of radio data that we will find in literature until today with some new addition. And yes, the radio spectrum is optically thin. At the very least, after 20 days, we can say for sure it was optically thin. So going back to the possibilities that we have of something that is mildly relativistic and decelerating in the environment, or something that instead is jetted, but it also decelerates in the environment. And what happens is that the radiation just comes into our line of sight later. So in both cases, the key word is deceleration. So here are our two possibilities. And now I'd like to go through the two simplest versions of these two models. And then we're going to complicate the story a little bit and see how they perform. So this is just to put some numbers. Some time scales and some energetics. I'm going to go quickly here. And what I'm showing here is the prediction that you get if you take the simplest version of a fireball with a unit gamma that is decelerating into the environment. It's going to give you this t to the third rise that is typical of this setup. If you check with the present day data, this prediction does not is not fulfilled, is not there. So you can either decide that the mildly relativistic scenario is out, or you can decide, well, let me complicate. Maybe the reality is a little bit more complicated, which is what it was done. So you put some structure in your ejecta. So you put, this is what was done in a paper by Mouly. So you have a structure in the gamma beta of your ejecta, and then you can match the data, no problem. So let's see how the relativistic jet would do. And I will use the simplest version of it, so the top hat, call it top hat uniform jet. And in that case, we are viewing off axis. We need to be off axis because the emission is rising. And again, keyword is deceleration in this case too. So what we did was to use the beautiful code that Andrew put together with his collaborators to simulate a very large variety of off-axis uniform jet models with spanning a broad range of parameters, including EK, kinetic isotropic energies, densities, observer angles, and microphysics as well. So here is some versions of it. So you can see the same jet as viewed by different observers at different angles in the X-rays. And you can see that there is one angle that is favored for this specific parameters would be something like 36 degrees. The same model, you can put the same model onto the radio data. This is just the data that were available in the first 2 weeks. And you can see that it also does a reasonably good job in the radio as well. So I want to make a point. This was not the best fit. It was part of a family, a huge family of possible solutions with this range of parameters, EK from 10 to the 49, 10 to the 50 ergs, a range of densities, a range of angles, and also a range of microphysics. It was a family of solutions, not just one. And the other point I want to make is that we are using the simplest possible jet model that we can come up with. And this is also limited to the first part of what we saw in the first 40 days of data. If you take just one of these models out of this entire family, and you plot it here, that is how it would miserably fail, and in blue. However, it would also have been possible, instead of using this early time fit, to instead use a fit from a more up-to-date paper, something that we published in the Guidarti et al. And you can see that off-axis uniform jet can still do a pretty nice job until, let's say, 50 days or so. So we can do something, we can go a step further, and we can use all the data that are out right now and see how this very, very simple jet model would do. And what you can see is that these models can do a reasonably good job here. And again, this is one out of a family of models that would do a similar thing. But the thing that we are missing out entirely is the very early evolution. So here is how I view a top-hat jet model. And the message that is coming from this underestimate of the very early time flux is that maybe we just need to put some wing into this jet, but the jet, an ultra-relativistic jet, maybe made it through in this event. And the question mark is what is going to happen in later times. So once we will get, we will be good in doing that. This is actually very interesting because in principle, we can also do something in the cosmology. So from gravitational waves alone, there is a degeneracy between the inclination angle, another name for the off-axis angle, and the Hubble constant measurement. So you can understand that if we start getting better in this job of understanding how off-axis we are, and if we start getting better in understanding if a jet is there or not, then we can solve this model degeneracy and say, hey, I'm here. And we can start measuring the Hubble constant as well. So those are the points that I wanted to make. I would say that episode 2 is going to happen soon with a new X-ray measurement. And one thing that I'd like to know is that, is there any potential future evolution of the cocoon models or jet models with the structure that would tell us which of the one is right? Because my worry is that both of them are flexible enough that we will remain with this doubt in our mind, unless maybe we start seeing some spectral evolution. And that's it.
Have more discussion. So she's put a question to the audience. Anybody want to take a stab at the answer? Oh, come on. Really? Okay. I actually do think that, you know, the issue isn't going to be necessarily in the future evolution of this event, but wouldn't you agree that in the sort of like statistics of all the events that will at least, you know, still not totally clear, you know, about the difference between the structured jet and the cocoon, mm-hmm. how like semantic that is. But I mean, I would say it's more of an issue of figuring out what that structure, what that distribution of mass yeah. and energy, partitioning of energy is. And wouldn't you agree that having this type of data on a series of events will reveal that?
Probably, but my real worry is that you can always come up with a solution for every single, that maybe is not unique for every event. I would really like to know if I think people disagree with that.
We've been talking about the structures, but in the plot that you showed from the recent radio paper, there are two different profiles for, I can't remember what they were, there are two different power laws, I think.
This one, it's the Moulis paper?
So there's the red line and the blue line, which look reasonably similar, but have very different, or have different structures and different energies. So I'm just wondering how much of it is predictive versus just having yeah. that as a range of free parameters of slopes and Lorentz mm. factors and energies.
Yeah.
Wait for the microphone and then you can answer.
Okay. So the free parameter here is the density. You can also add epsilon B if you want. What you can take from it, which is basically robust and independent of anything, is a distribution of energy with velocities. Mm-hmm. This gamma beta to the minus 5, this is what robust. So you need to have, this is what, this is giving you the slope, basically. And this slope is not very different between the relativistic part and the Newtonian part, and therefore you have both, one of them is more relativistic, both of them are mildly relativistic, but one is slightly more, one slightly less, they both produce the same thing. Normalization is given by the density, higher density is lower velocity, and that's it. And the only thing which is robust here is this distribution. And between the first point and the last point, you need 10 times more energy, and you need the velocity to go to the density, to the velocity structure to do it.
When you say robust, you mean robust for this event or robust from
this event.
From the this point of simulation?
What you see here are three curves. Two of them are synthetic, fully synthetic. We just took a power law, looked for the power law that give you fit for the data. Okay. One of them is an outcome from a simulation that was done long before the data was acquired and put on this data without any fit.
So you're saying that this is a prediction. Essentially, the black line is every single event should look like this. Or what is that? I'm trying to understand the robustness here. What is robust? Because I understand you saying for this event, for this particular light curve, the robust part is the -5. But as a, since we're pushing to the question that was raised about future events, what is the robust prediction of this?
I'm not sure exactly what is the question because.
Well, I'm saying the question is, what is the robust?
The prediction will depend on the viewing angle, the properties of the jet, and the properties of the ejector. Every different viewing angle, jet, ejector, will give you a different prediction.
So I think that's exactly the concern
that's
of Rafaela
my,
has, which is essentially that every event is its own special snowflake,
yeah.
And every event you can always tweak the parameters to get what you want.
One of the things which is general here, for example, is that you will have material which is moving with a Lorentz factor of 2 or 3, and that it will be energetic. This will always give you, if you look at the right observing angle, something which is rising for, I don't know, about 100 days. After 100 days, you can have different stories. Looking at the same event from a different angle, it will be different. Yes, in this sense, yeah, this is true. For example, you can also an observer at 90 degrees will see something significant from this emission. It will be different. Observer at 90 degrees will see something different from a jet, which carries more energy, and was a mildly relativistic material which carries most of the energy. It's how much energy you have at which Lorentz factor. That's it. What determines it? Physically? I think that physically is the interaction of the jet and the material. That's it. It's how long the jet is operating, is what the opening angle of the jet, is how much material you have around. In principle, if you allow me to do everything with anything, I can do many things. I can put zero, I can put zero material, no cocoon. Okay. I can put so much material, it will never break out. Not only never break out. Whatever is going out will go, there will be no effect for the jet. I can do many things. I don't know what nature does.
So
I would like to.
Going into this then, so a lot of this now has been from the radio and X-ray perspective, but a lot of how I started thinking about the cocoon model was in that it's this other way to power this early blue emission. And so there it's whether it's you get some extra power from the shock heating that ends up showing up in the blue optical light, as well as opposed to it all just being from radioactive heating, you actually have shock heating as well. So do both of these things, even if they both explain the radio and X-ray, and especially again tying into Juno's, as we start viewing things from different angles and know them, does the coupling between that radio and X-ray and what types of blue optical emission, does that actually help you distinguish it from that perspective?
Yeah, I don't know, because you can also, the blue thing, we can also explain it in other ways. So you can always say the blue thing is not a cocoon. So I'm not sure it's a unique.
But whether it's by coupling those together for many events, you can start to, because the angle matters for a lot of the different ways of creating the blue light.
Yeah, I think that among all, I like this idea of trying to see what happens if the event is 90 degrees. I think that that might be a good test. Maybe that is the way.
The early emission is coming from the cocoon, the luminosity should be going down. If it's coming just from regular ejecta, which is ejected with a velocity of about 0.2, it should be going up. So we're missing this 11 hours.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can say from our perspective, it was that early. It was indeed that early time that it convinced us of the cocoon. And I guess, Rafael, I would ask you, you know, maybe this like late time X-ray and radio is just a waste of time, and we should just be focusing on the early UV and.
I would not go and say it's a waste of time.
Okay.
Because I think that after 1,000 days, maybe things start to deviate. But what I wanted to say is that the observations that we will get to know better tomorrow are not. I don't think they're going to set this debate in particular, because they are on. They can be on the same spectrum.
Yes. Now, one thing, I don't know if it was discussed this morning, I missed the gamma ray section, but I was wondering whether the gamma ray emission could be a discriminant between cocoon and jet, because to me, the cocoon, it's not clear to me how the cocoon is going to make the non-thermal high energy emission. Maybe it was, I missed that.
No, we don't know. We have a full session.
So the corrected short gamma ray burst rate is essentially the same as the neutron star merger rate. What does that tell you about you know, the jetted emission?
Well, it's a good clue. Yeah, I agree. But it's a good clue that they do agree with that. At the same time, and maybe I'm going to say something that is totally heretical here, what if we will find out that short GRBs also get the thing that we call short GRBs, maybe they get some black hole neutron star mergers. So.
Right. I mean, I guess I could open this up more broadly.
Yeah.
At what point do, you know, having those two numbers be essentially the same cause problems?
They are not necessarily the same. So they might be the same, but we're not sure about the true rate about short GRBs because
we don't know
the true beaming. Yeah. So you have about one order, maybe more, 1.5 orders of magnitude. We also don't know exactly what is the rate of neutron star merger. So if we take the PTF constraints, then we actually do. And then it fits quite well to what you expect of short GRBs. If some mergers like this are different, the optical color is different, and then the constraint from the PTF is less robust, then it might be higher. So we still have a free freedom here, but it seems similar.
I feel like our blue kilonova folks have been sort of like neglected in a lot of this. So can we have you guys say, like, we don't care about your argument of cocoon and jet, like, forget it. Do you guys want to comment? Back there, air?
Saudi, when you replied to Maria about what can the blue emission help to constrain cocoon versus non-cocoon, and you said, yeah, if it's rising or it's declining, which is kind of why I was obsessing about what's happening in that first data point. My conclusion was that it's hard to say what's happening in the bolometric luminosity, which I know modelers prefer to compare their models to the bolometric. But I'm sorry, we don't know what's happening in the UV at those early times, so I can't tell you if the bolometric is rising or declining. I don't think anyone can, whatever kind of extrapolation you try to do. It's right at the limit of depending what the UV is doing, it could be rising or declining. But definitely the G band is at least flat, the R band is rising. Can the cocoon, the shock cooling for the cocoon models be constrained by that? Or can they fit that, or do we not know?
I mean, I just say that if you have something that's rapidly cooling, it could be rising in the redder band. So that doesn't rule that out. I agree that that G band point at like 0.9 days is maybe flatter, and so that's maybe on the edge of being difficult to explain. But it's just that's the only data point that's maybe in tension.
Elliot.
Ben had a...
I mean, it's perhaps worth noting that in Monsi and Udi's plot showing the different components, the cocoon, the blue kilonova, the cocoon emission actually doesn't contribute very much at times that were actually observed in this event. So I would say in most people's models, perhaps your and Tony's aside, most of the emission is assumed to be radioactively powered.
Yeah, that's just, that's not all of, all cocoons aren't the same.
So this is maybe somewhat of a clarification just to myself, but maybe an open question. Could it be that some of the semantics between the cocoon and the jet sort of camps or models is just whether or not we have structure in the lateral direction or whether or not we have structure in the radial direction? Although, you know, realistically, we might have, we should have both. But, right, is that essentially one qualitative difference between...
So I would say that the main difference is if we have a core of ultra-relativistic stuff that made it through or not. I think, no, no, it's no, no, no. Your jet didn't
So first of all, cocoon has structure both in both of them, and the jet can go through.
Yeah, but yours didn't.
Is that the physical origin of the structure? Is the physical, the difference is the physical origin of the structure. In the cocoon, the physical origin is the structure of the ejecta. In what I call structure jet, the physical origin is the structure of the launching. Of course, the structure in which you launch can also affect the evolution in the interaction with the ejecta. This is clear. But this is the way that I distinguish between them. And okay, that's it.
Just a question. I mean, is the distinction about how bimodal it is? So, I mean, this event was, you know, four orders of magnitude dimmer than a typical GRB. If there's some angular dependence, can we say, or why don't we see something? Is it really bimodal between the classical GRBs and this wimpy one? Or shouldn't we see something in between for either the structure jet or the cocoon model?
This actually, in most version of a structure jet, you have a gradual change with the angle of everything. And this is actually can be ruled, almost ruled out by observations. Because we have a very tight correlation between the after, if you look at short GRBs, forget about this event. In short GRBs and also in long GRBs, we have very tight correlation between the afterglow energy and the gamma rays energy. Now, consider a situation where we had some structure where the amount of gamma rays emitted changing with angle somehow. And it's going by four orders of magnitude when you get to very high angles. So now the afterglow doesn't know really about the observing angle exactly. Because once it's decelerating, say, for to a Lorentz factor 10, which happens after about a day, everything is the same up to opening angle of about 5 degrees. So if we had this structure, we'd see events which are faint in gamma rays and bright in afterglow. And we don't see them. This will ruin this correlation. So, of course, you can make structure which will be sharp enough. You can make structure which changes the energy but doesn't change the gamma ray production. You can do many things, but it's not natural.
So let us thank Rafael again for a very stimulating talk.